This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Lily and the Octopus by Stephen Rowley. Read by Michael Urie.
For Lily. The Law for the Wolves. Now this is the law of the jungle, as old and as true as the sky. And the wolf that shall keep it may prosper, but the wolf that shall break it must die. As the creeper that girdles the tree trunk, the law runneth forward and back. For the strength of the pack is the wolf, and the strength of the wolf is the pack. Rudyard Kipling. The Octopus. It's Thursday the first time I see it. I know that it's Thursday because Thursday nights are the nights my dog, Lily, and I set aside to talk about boys we think are cute. She's 12 in actual years, which is 84 in dog years. I'm 42, which is 294 in dog years. But like a really young 294, because I'm in pretty good shape, and a lot of people tell me I could pass for 238, which is actually 34. I say this about our ages because we're both a little immature and tend to like younger guys. We get into long debates over the Ryans. I'm a Gosling man, whereas she's a Reynolds gal, even though she can't name a single movie of his that she would ever watch twice. We dropped Philippi years ago over a disagreement as to how to pronounce his name. Philippi? Philippe? Also because he doesn't work that much anymore. Then there's the Matts and the Toms. We go back and forth between Bomer and Damon and Brady and Hardy, depending on what kind of week it has been. And finally, the Bradleys, Cooper and Milton, the latter of whom is technically way older and long dead, and I'm not sure why my dog keeps bringing him up other than she loves board games, which we usually play on Fridays. Anyhow, this particular Thursday we are discussing the Chrises, Hemsworth and Evans and Pine. It's when Lily suggests offhandedly we also include Chris Pratt that I notice the octopus. It's not often you see an octopus up close, let alone in your living room, let alone perched on your dog's head like a birthday party hat. So I'm immediately taken aback. I have a good view of it as Lily and I are sitting on opposite sides of the couch, each with a pillow, me sitting Indian style, her perched more like the MGM lion. Lily, we don't have to include Chris Pratt. It was just a suggestion, she says. No, what's that on your head? I ask. Two of the octopus's arms hang down her face like chin straps. Where? What do you mean, where? There. Over your temple on the right side. Lily pauses. She looks at me for a moment, our eyes locked on each other. She breaks my gaze only to glance upward at the octopus. Oh, that. Yes, that. I immediately lean in and grab her snout, the way I used to when she was a pup and would bark too much, so excited by the very existence of each new thing encountered that she had to sing her enthusiasm with sharp staccato notes.
Look at this! It is the most amazing thing I've ever seen! It's a great time to be alive!
Once, when we first lived together, and the time it took me to shower, she managed to relocate all of my size 13 shoes to the top of the staircase, three rooms away. When I asked her why, her reply was pure conviction.
These things you put on feet should be closer to the stairs!
So full of ebullience and ideas. I pull her closer to me and turn her head to the side so I can get a good, long look. She gives me the most side eye she can muster in annoyance, disgusted with both the molestation and unwanted attention, and my gaucheness as a big, stupid human man. The octopus has a good grip and clings tightly over her eye. It takes me a minute, but I gather my nerve and poke it. It's harder than I would have imagined. Less like a water balloon, more like bone. It feels subcutaneous. Yet there it is. Out in the open for all to see. I count its arms, turning Lily's head around to the back, and sure enough, there are 8. The octopus looks angry as much as out of place. Aggressive, perhaps, is a better word. Like it is announcing itself, and would like the room. I'm not going to lie. It's as frightening as it is confounding. I saw a video somewhere, sometime, of an octopus that camouflaged itself so perfectly along the ocean floor that it was completely undetectable until some unfortunate whelk or crab or snail came along, and it emerged, striking with deadly precision. I remember going back and watching the video again and again, trying to locate the octopus in hiding. After countless viewings, I could acknowledge its presence, sense its energy, its lurking, its intent to pounce, even if I couldn't entirely make out its form. Once you had seen it, you couldn't really unsee it, even as you remained impressed with its ability to hide so perfectly in plain sight. This is like that. Now that I've seen it, I can't unsee it. And the octopus transforms Lily's entire face. A face that has always been so handsome to me. A noble and classic dog profile, betrayed only slightly by a dachshund's ridiculous body. Still, that face. Perfect in its symmetry. When you pulled her ears back, it was like a small bowling pin covered in the softest mahogany fur. But now, she looks less like a bowling pin in shape, and more like a worn-down bowling pin in occupation. Her head sports a lump, as if it had actually been the number one pin in a 10-pin formation. Lily snorts at me twice with flared nostrils, and I realize I'm still holding her snout. I let go of her, knowing she is seething at the indignity of it all.
"I don't want to talk about it,"
she says, tucking her head to gnaw at an itch on her stomach. "Well, I do want to talk about it. Mostly I want to talk about how it could be possible that I've never seen it before, how I could be responsible for every aspect of her daily life and well-being, food, water, exercise, toys, chews, inside, outside, medication, elimination, entertainment, snuggling, affection, love, and not notice that one side of her head sports an octopus, alarmingly increasing it in size. The octopus is a master of disguise, I remind myself. Its intent is to stay hidden. But even as I say this silently in my head, I wonder why I'm letting myself so easily off the hook. Does it hurt? There's a sigh, an exhale. When Lily was younger, in her sleep, she would make a similar noise, usually right before her legs would start racing, the preamble to a beautiful dream about chasing squirrels or birds, or pounding the warm sand on an endless golden beach. I don't know why, but I think of Ethan Hawke answering the standard questionnaire inspired by Bernard Pivot that ended every episode of Inside the Actor's Studio. What sound or noise do you love? Puppies sighing, Ethan had said. Yes! Such a wonderful juxtaposition, sighing puppies. As if warm, sleeping puppies felt anything lamentable, or had weariness or exasperations to sigh over. And yet they sighed all the time. Exhalations of sweet, innocent breath. But this sigh is different, subtly. To the untrained ear, it might not be noticeable, but I know Lily about as well as I think it's possible to know another living thing. So I notice it. There's a heaviness to it, a creakiness. There are cares in her world. There is weight, on her shoulders. I ask her again. Does it hurt? Her answer comes slowly after great pause and consideration.
Sometimes.
The very best thing about dogs is how they just know when you need them most, and they'll drop everything that they're doing to sit with you a while. I don't need to press Lily further. I can do what she has done for me countless times, through heartbreak and illness and depression, and days of general uneasiness and malaise. I can sit with her quietly, our bodies touching, just enough to generate warmth, to share the vibrating energy of all living things, until our breathing slows and falls into the parallel rhythm it always does when we have our quietest sits. I pinch the skin on the back of her neck as I imagine her mother once did to carry her when she was a pup. There's a wind coming, I tell her. Staring down the octopus as much as I dare, I fear there's more truth to that statement than I'd like. Mostly, I am setting Lily up to deliver her favorite line from Elizabeth, the Golden Age. Neither of us has actually seen the film, but they played this exchange endlessly in the commercials back when it was in theaters, and we both would collapse in fits of laughter at the sound of Cate Blanchett bellowing and carrying on as the Virgin Queen. My dog does the best Cate Blanchett impression. Lily perks up just a bit and delivers her response on cue. I, too, can command the wind, sir. I have a hurricane in me that will strip Spain bare if you dare to try me. Let them come with the armies of hell. They will not pass. It's a good effort, one she makes for me. But if I'm being honest, it isn't her best. Instinctually, she probably already knows what is fast becoming clear to me. She is the whelk. She is the crab. She is the snail. The octopus is hungry, and it is going to have her. Camouflage. Friday afternoon. My therapist's office is painted the color of unsalted butter. Sitting in that office on the couch, with the one broken spring that made it just maddeningly shy of comfortable, I have often thought of shoving the whole room into a mixing bowl with brown sugar and flour and vanilla and chocolate chips. I crave cookies when I'm annoyed, when I feel I know better than those around me. Crisp on the outside, chewy on the inside, fresh-baked chocolate chip cookies, warm from the oven. With the chocolate soft, but not melted. I don't know the derivation of this comfort craving, but there's a quote from Cookie Monster that's always inhabited my head. Today, me will live in the moment, unless it's unpleasant, in which case, me will eat a cookie. While I don't take all of my mantras from goggle-eyed blue monsters with questionable grammar, this one has taken root. Lately, I've been craving cookies a lot. My therapist's name is Jenny, which is not a name you should accept for a therapist. Ever. A gymnast, perhaps. Forrest Gump's wife, sure. A worker at one of those frozen yogurt places where you pump your own yogurt and all they have to do is weigh it and they still think their job is tough. But not a therapist. I just don't think people take Jennies seriously. Case in point. My name is Edward Flask, but people call me Ted. Something I insisted upon after the unfortunate nickname Special Ed followed me through grade school because I was so shy. I can see my name scrawled in Jenny's handwriting across the top of a legal pad on her lap, but the T in Ted is bolder, clearly an addition she made after remembering no one calls me Ed. And I've been seeing her for months. Still, Jenny takes my insurance and has an office that is adjacent to my neighborhood, at least by Los Angeles standards. The conclusions she draws are always the wrong ones, but I've gotten good at taking her dim-witted advice and filtering it through the mind of an imaginary and much smarter therapist to get the insight into my life that I need. That by itself sounds dysfunctional, but it happens to work for me. I entered therapy after I ended my last relationship 18 months ago. 6 years in, and maybe 2 years after I should have. It started out strong. We met at the New Beverly Cinema after a screening of Billy Wilder's The Apartment, and we argued about its merits. Jeffrey was smart, scary smart, and passionate. When I blanched at The Apartment's themes of infidelity and adultery, Jeffrey pressed me on my professed love for another of Wilder's films, The 7-Year Itch. At first, his charisma made it addictive to be around him. But over time, I recognized it was also a facade. There was a wounded boy inside of him. He had grown up without a dad, so it made sense to me that he sought constant validation. I found it endearing, humanizing. Until he started to indulge that little boy. There were tantrums. There was acting out. There was his need to control things that he had no business controlling. But he was still that boy, and I loved him. So I stayed, thinking it would get better. And then one morning I woke up to one of life's clarion calls. I deserved better than this. That night I said I was leaving. After more than a year off from dating, I'm finally putting myself out there again, dipping my toes in old waters from which I thought I had long since sailed downstream. Jenny asks me about this. How is that going? That? Yes. Dating? Uh-huh. It's the last thing I want to talk about. The octopus has almost as tight a grip on my head as it does on Lily's, and yet I can't bring myself to tell Jenny about our unwanted visitor. At least not yet. I can't show my hand, expose the fear that the octopus brings, and have her say all the wrong things, as she's all but guaranteed to do. Jenny. I can't do her work for her, not on this. I would rather do her work without her, which means, for now, holding this one close to my chest. Shouldn't even have come. Shouldn't have left Lily alone with the octopus, but the sunlight was streaming through the kitchen windows in the exact way that she likes, and the long beams of late afternoon would provide her ample warmth for a long nap. I couldn't get an appointment with the veterinarian until Monday, and something in me thinks the sun could be healing. That it might irradiate our visitor, desiccate our fish out of water. Are octopuses fish? I ask it out loud without meaning to. Are octopuses what? Fish. Are they considered fish? No, I think they're cephalopods. Figures Jenny would know that. She was probably one of those girls who wanted to grow up to be a marine biologist before she went off to college and fell for a psych major with big masculine hands and a name like Chad. I wish I was curled up on the floor in the sun beside Lily. I wish I could lay my hand on her like I did when she was a pup, to let her know that all that worried her would be okay so long as I was there. It's where I belong instead of here. What about dating, though? Jenny snaps me back to attention. Dating. I don't know. It's fine. Uneventful. Soporific. Juvenile? She asks. Not sophomoric. God, I want cookies. Soporific. You know, tedious. Tiresome. Why is it tiresome? Because it is. Cookies. It's always interesting to meet new people, isn't it? Couldn't you look at it that way? I could. I say it in a stubborn way to make it clear that I don't, and I won't. I don't know if it's me. Maybe I'm not ready to date. I don't know if it's them. Maybe the good ones are already taken. I don't know if it's my age. Los Angeles is a neverland of lost boys who preen and crow far too often and demonstrate substance far too seldom. I started dating with enthusiasm and put my best foot forward in the task. But soon, I found myself on a string of first dates where I couldn't remember if the story I was telling was one I had already told, or if it was a story I had told a previous date, a night or two earlier. In an effort not to be boring, I had concocted a string of my best anecdotes, a highlight reel of witticisms, and in employing them over and over again, I ended up boring myself. All of this I should be saying out loud, if only because my insurance company is paying for the time, and I am paying for my insurance. As a freelance writer, it's no small expense. But instead, I offer an anemic... I don't know. Tell me, Jenny implores. No. Come on. Tumor me. The octopus swooshes its powerful arms in front of me, and in a chaotic flash exposes its hungry beak as it leaps for my face. I flinch, swatting my hands in front of my nose. What did you just say? It comes across as accusatory. Jenny looks at me, concerned. She has to see the sweat forming just along my brow line. I look frantically around the room for the octopus, but, as quickly as it appeared, it is gone. I said, humor me. Her concern melts into a smile. Did she? My butter prison is closing in. The walls seem closer than they did 5 minutes ago. This is usually a sign of an oncoming panic attack. They used to be rare, but lately I've had several. The best way to stave off a full-blown meltdown is to do the one thing I don't want to do. Talk about dating. To remember life continuing. To not give in to that which causes the panic. So, I relent. There's this one guy. Handsome. Smart. Funny. Handsome. I said that twice, didn't I? Well, his looks merit it. I just can't tell if he's that interested. In you. In the art of puppeteering. I cross my arms protectively. Of course in me. We went out a second time, and it was good. This is stupid. I should be talking about the octopus. But I can't think about the octopus. I can't feed the panic. But still, I didn't know if he was interested. In me. So I thought when we say goodnight the second time, if he tries to kiss me, that'll be some indication. And if he tries to hug me, I won't break the hug first. Pleased with that plan, I point to my head like it's more than just a hat rack. Then I realize perhaps the octopus is hiding on my head, heads being a place he seems to be fond of, and I give myself a top-to-bottom pat-down. Jenny looks at me like I'm experiencing some sort of debilitating seizure, but forges ahead. Smart. Then you could see if the hug was a friendly hug or a romantic hug. So, what happened? I broke the hug first. Jenny looks at me, disappointed. Defensively, well, he didn't break the hug either, so we were just standing there like two stroke victims propping each other up. The walls are now so dangerously close that I wonder if they will crush me, or if I will be pressed into their buttery softness, creating a perfect mold of my form after I suffocate in clotted cream. That, in itself, should have told you something. Jenny makes a doodle on her notepad, darkening the ed in my name to match the bolded T. She's being paid to listen to me, and even she finds me boring. But it's not her fault. Less than 24 hours since the arrival of our cephalopod houseguest, I already recognize a trait we share. I, too, am hiding in plain sight. I am walking through life invisible, skulking like a failure, hoping few people notice me. I've been doing that since things went south with Jeffrey.
I think you need to allow for the fact that some people have difficulty expressing themselves, Jenny muses.
Jenny always employs the phrase, some people, when she's talking about me. But, once again, this is the wrong conclusion. This guy did not have problems expressing himself. I do not have problems expressing myself. This guy just didn't know if he liked me, and that made me anxious. Even if it was my fault, he didn't know. Even if I was not letting myself be seen.
C is for cookie, that's good enough for me. Cookie, cookie, cookie starts with C.
I filter her analysis through the voice of my preferred imaginary therapist, and he comes up with sharper advice. It has only been 2 dates. Why do I need to know how this guy feels about me? Why does everything have to be settled? Do I even know if I like him? I mean, beyond his looks. I have to be better about living in the not knowing. And suddenly it's not about dating. It's about the octopus. I have to be better about living in the not knowing. Friday evening. June in Los Angeles is the opposite of June everywhere else. Here, it means only one thing. Gloom. The sun disappears behind clouds, and fog and smog and haze, and doesn't reappear for weeks. Normally I like it. Normally I'm fine with it, being the price we pay to have sunshine the rest of the year. But tonight there's no sunset, and it bothers me. Trent calls and proposes dinner, and I say no. But Trent doesn't take no for an answer, so I say yes to save us from going 12 rounds. I feel bad about leaving Lily even for another hour, but I also know I need to talk to someone. And if it's not going to be Jenny, it might as well be Trent. He knows how to get through to me, and always has ever since we met on our first day of college in Boston. He was a loud Texan, and I was a quiet Mainer, and I was immediately captivated by his southern charm, much as he was fascinated with my northern chill. It was a friendship that worked from the moment he knocked on the door of my dorm room and asked if I wanted to walk to 7-Eleven for cigarettes. He was the Ferris Bueller to my Cameron Fry. From the time we were 22, Trent would tell me not to worry. He said it was all going to happen for us when we were 29. Bad breakup? Who cares? Dead-end job? It wasn't a waste of time. Any other stress? Why waste even a moment caring? It was all going to happen when we were 29. I questioned him at first. Why 29? Why not 28? And then I started to panic. What if it didn't happen to me until I was 31? I didn't know how to use swear words correctly until the 7th grade, or what the internet was until 1995. I worried about falling behind. Still, the bravado of the statement and the confidence with which he delivered it eventually made me a believer. I never bothered to ask what it was, the it that was going to happen for us. I'm not confident he entirely knew. And then in the very waning hours of my 29th year, I found Lily. The day before my 30th birthday. Trent is already inside the restaurant when I get there. It's our usual place. We like it because when you order a martini, it comes in a chilled martini glass, and then when you're halfway through the drink, they bring you a fresh chilled martini glass for the rest of it. They even transfer the drink for you and bring you fresh olives. Astonishing, right? Service. Hi, friend. I ordered you a martini, he says. Thanks. Do you have the other thing? Teddy, he says, scolding me for even thinking he might have forgotten. He slides a single Valium across the table. I put the pill into my mouth, chewing it slightly before I press it under my tongue. It works faster if you press it under your tongue. Trent gives me a minute to make it happen. Are you going to tell me what's the matter? I hold up my finger for him to wait as I carefully massage the pill fragments between my tongue and lower jaw until they dissolve. Lily has an octopus. The words taste chalky and raw, and they're out of my mouth before I can stop them, which means I really do need to talk about this. Trent looks confused. What? An octopus. On her head. Above her eye. Spelling it out does nothing to alleviate his confusion. He's giving me a look, so I sum it up and say, kind of like yours. Trent is the only other person I know who has had an octopus other than, like, on a salad. His came in 1997. We were roommates then, here in Los Angeles. I found him one night on the couch rubbing his calf and looking bewildered. My leg is numb, he said. I don't know if it's my imagination or my anticipation of the Valium's effect, but I exhale and ease into a diazepam vision of Trent and me at 26, our old, dilapidated apartment, as real to me as when we lived there. Turns out the left side of his body had been growing numb for months, and a doctor-ordered MRI revealed an octopus still in its infancy. Within weeks, he was in surgery, and although it was traumatic at the time, his recovery was quick, and we soon put it behind us. Later, I wondered why it took him so long to say something. We routinely spent hours analyzing every last one of life's events and details. That time, we broke up a lesbian fistfight. The proper thread count for sheets, and what made Egyptian cotton so great. How many celebrities we could realistically get to come to one of our parties. Why we always burned oatmeal. Was it okay to ask out a male nurse I met on 50-cent drink night at the Apache? Why did we go to a bar called the Apache in the first place? 50-cent drinks. There was plenty of time for it to come up before I found him on the couch looking confused. Trent taps me on my arm and I look up. The restaurant is busy tonight. Busier than usual. You drifted, Trent says. The Valium must be kicking in. How was it like mine? Well, not exactly like yours, because you couldn't see yours. But Lily's is just sitting on top of her head for all to see. Her octopus. Yes. I never had an octopus. Yes, you did. And if you didn't, I'd like to know what the hell they took out of you at Cedars when they cut open your skull. They took out it. He starts before stopping. What the hell do you think we're talking about? I thought we were talking about an octopus. Exactly. Our martinis arrive. Three olives each. We sip our drinks in silence. The vodka is a cold salve on my throat, and a welcome way to wash the powdery aftertaste from under my tongue. It burns as I swish it around my mouth. Do you want to get the deviled eggs? I don't know why he's asking me this, because I always want to get the deviled eggs. He flags down the waitress and puts in an order. I don't even have to say yes. Did you call the vet? I nod. They can't see her until Monday. When did you first notice the... octopus? Last night. It just showed up. If it was there before, I didn't notice. It's weird, though. It doesn't really move. It just sits there with its arms hanging down the side of her face. I think it's... sleeping. Trent muddles two of his olives into his martini with his fingers, and I pull one of mine off the toothpick with my teeth. I can see him doing math in his head. How old is Lily again? No. What? No. I am firm. I can see what you're doing, weighing the probative value of my options here. One, I haven't been to the veterinarian yet, and I don't know what's involved in removing an octopus that's clinging to her head. Octopusectomy. Two, I am not letting that thing have her. I won't allow it. In my 20s, I had another terrible therapist. Therapists. Who concluded that since my mother never says, I love you, at least not in the same way that other mothers do, there was going to be a limit to my ability to feel love. Love for someone, loved by someone. I was limited. And then, on the very last night of my 20s, when I held my new puppy in my arms, I broke down in tears. Because I had fallen in love. Not somewhat in love. Not partly in love. Not in a limited amount. I fell fully in love with a creature I had known for all of 9 hours. I remember Lily licking the tears from my face.
This eye rain you make is fantastic! I love the salty taste! You should make this every day!
The realization was overwhelming. There was nothing wrong with me. There were no limits to what I could feel. And just as Trent had predicted, with only moments left to go on the clock, it all happened for me when I was 29. I slam my fists on the table and the silverware jumps and the vodka sloshes to the very rim of our glasses, and I grit my teeth and glare. It cannot have her. A chill runs down Trent's spine. I know this because a chill runs down my own. He puts his hands over mine to calm me. He has a dog, a bulldog named Wheezy. He loves her like I love Lily. He knows my heart. He understands. He would fight this fight. The waitress comes with our deviled eggs and with two freshly chilled glasses and transfers the rest of our martinis. She smiles at us awkwardly and disappears. I watch as ice sluices down the side of my new glass in slow motion. It cannot have her. Friday night. Friday nights are my favorite nights. You wouldn't think a 12-year-old dachshund would be good at Monopoly, but you'd be wrong there. She can stack up hotels along one side of the board like nobody's business, and usually does so with little commiseration for others who might not be able to afford her upscale rents. Me, on the other hand, I like the first side of the board, the one with the deep purple and light blue properties with vaguely racist names like Oriental Avenue. Something about the color palette on that side of the board calms me. Lily is colorblind. She doesn't undertake any such considerations when buying property. Also, I never feel too aggressive buying hotels on those properties, if I'm lucky enough to get the monopoly. The rents are reasonable, and people are usually flush from having just passed go. I guess I just don't have the killer instinct. Lily always makes fun of me when I want to be the wheelbarrow or the shoe. She considers these the game pieces of weak, feckless players. She always wants to be the cannon, or the battleship, or the shot glass. I haven't had the heart to tell her she's been playing that piece upside down and it's actually a thimble. She would be furious if she ever found out. Tonight, our hearts aren't really in it, but it's what we do on Friday nights, so we go through the motions. I might have suggested we just skip it and do something less involved, like watch a movie, although Saturday nights are usually movie night. But I'm feeling some guilt from having left earlier today for therapy and dinner with Trent. As always, I have to roll the dice, move her game piece, conduct the transactions, buy her houses and hotels, and be the banker, because, well, she's a dog. Double fours. That's doubles two times in a row. One more time and you go to jail, I say. She lands on one of the green properties. North Carolina Avenue. No one owns it. Do you want to buy it? She shrugs. She is a shell of my usual Monopoly partner, both of our minds elsewhere. But while I'm putting on a brave face, maybe it's the vodka and Valium, she's just warming a chair. I look across at her. As always, I put a pillow on her seat so she can see above the tabletop, but tonight she looks smaller to me. Maybe she was always that small. I don't think she's ever weighed more than 17 pounds. But her presence in my life has always been outsized. Do you not want to play? We don't have to play. She sniffs at her pile of money. When she bows her head, I can see the octopus, so I look away. I've decided not to engage it, to look at it, to talk to it, to even acknowledge it, until our vet appointment on Monday. And we'll see how long that lasts.
Tell me again about my mother.
This is something Lily likes to hear from time to time. It used to bother me, her curiosity about where she came from. I guess maybe I was feeling some remorse about tearing her away from her dachshund family when she was only 12 weeks old, away from her mother and father and brother and sisters, who later came to be called Harry and Kelly and Rita. But now it's a story I like to tell. It's a story about beginnings and heritage. And our place in the greater world. Your mother's name was Ebony Flyer, but people called her Witchy Poo. Your father's name was Caesar, after a great Roman general. I only met your mother once, on the day that you and I were introduced.
My mother's name was Witchy Poo?
It was a beautiful day, the first week of May, spring. I drove hours into the country to this old white farmhouse with clabbered siding and peeling paint. My heart in my throat the whole way. I was so nervous. I wanted you to like me. The place sat a ways back from the road, and the lawn was almost yellow. We hadn't had much rain that spring, which was good for you, and bad for just about everyone else.
I hate the rain.
Yes, you and every other dog. Anyhow, there was a little wire pen on the front lawn, and inside were you and Harry and Kelly and Rita tumbling all over one another like noodles in a pot of boiling water. It was hard to even tell where one of you ended and the other one began. You were just like a pile of paws and tails. So the lady who lived there picked you up and set you gently on the grass. The four of you ambled and tumbled and stumbled and bumbled, and I stood there thinking, how on earth am I ever going to choose?
But you did. You chose me.
Lily picks up a little red wooden hotel and chews it enough to put a few teeth marks on it before spitting it out onto a railroad. Normally this is not behavior I would allow, but she does it quite gently, sort of nonchalantly. No, no, that's not true, exactly, I say, and she looks up at me startled. Like any good adoptive parent, I have always fed her that line of horse shit. A mommy and daddy who have a baby get stuck with whatever baby they get, but adoptive parents choose their baby, and so they love them that much more. Of course, in most cases, it's blatantly untrue. Adoptive parents are lucky to get the call whenever and wherever they do, and so they get the baby they get, just the same as parents who actually give birth.
No?
Lily sounds offended. No, I repeat, because it's the truth. Then I pause for dramatic effect. You, in fact, chose me. And she did. While Harry and Kelly and Rita carried on in a game that involved rolling and somersaulting, Lily broke free from the group and wandered over to where I was standing, talking to the lady who bred them. I was thinking of keeping the boy one myself, unless you have particular use for him. He's high-spirited, but I think he can be trained to show. I hadn't given much thought to whether I wanted a boy or a girl, not wanting to appear sexist and get on the wrong side of the woman who had the sole say in whether I'd be taking one of her puppies home. I said, no, I'd be glad to choose from among the girls. I studied the pups, looking for the girls, and was at a loss to tell which one was male. I would have to pick each one up and make a subtle determination. Worse than appearing sexist would be to come off as a pervert. It was then that I noticed the puppy who became Lily gnawing on my shoelace. She clamped down and put herself in reverse until the lace had been gently untied. Hello, you adorable... I crouched down and made my inspection. Girl? That's the runt, that one there, the lady replied, just this side of dismissively. I picked up the runt, and she snuggled under my chin, tail wagging like the pendulum of the smallest, most fragile grandfather clock. I'm Edward. People call me Ted, I whispered into her ear before lowering my own ear to the top of her head. I heard her speak for the first time.
This is my home now!
And so it was. I choose this one, I told the lady. You can have your pick of any one, the male, even if you really want. I'm not sure this one will show all that well. All the same, I'm not really interested in showing her, so I choose this one. I worried for a second she was going to try to discourage me further from choosing this puppy. She studied us both for a moment, as I held the runt protectively, and eventually her face softened and relented. I wondered if she wasn't just relieved to have someone take the runt so she could charge more for the rest of her flawless litter. Seems like she kind of chose you. And then after a beat, I suppose that's how it works. She finished with the off-center smile of a car salesman who's just sold a lemon for nearly full price. I tell Lily the story over the Monopoly board, and she seems satisfied, touched even. I smile at her, but sideways, so I don't have to acknowledge the octopus. She shakes her head, and her ears flop back and forth, and the familiar chime of her collar and dog tags jingle the room alive. It's only after she stops that I realize I've been gripping my chair so tightly my fingers are white. I suppose I was hoping she would shake her head so violently that the octopus would lose its grip, sail across the room, and splat against the wall, dying instantly. For the first time tonight, I look at her head on, and the octopus is still there, still holding on tight. Only now, and I kid you not, the son of a bitch is smiling at me. You motherfucker. Lily looks at me confused.
What?
I compose myself as quickly as I can. It's your turn, I say, hoping to re-engage her in the game.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is. You rolled double fours, so you get to roll again. Do you want me to roll for you?
Does it look like I've suddenly grown hands?
She's learned that sarcasm from me, something I used to be proud of, but now find abrasive. I roll the dice. Double twos. Lily and I look at each other for a few long seconds. Both of us know what it means. I reluctantly pick up her battleship and move it directly to jail. Saturday, late afternoon. There are times when Los Angeles is the most magical city on Earth. When the Santa Ana winds sweep through and the air is warm and so, so clear. When the jacaranda trees bloom in the most brilliant lilac violet. When the ocean sparkles on a warm February day and you're pushing fine grains of sand through your bare toes, while the rest of the country is hunkered down under blankets, slurping soup. But other times, like when the jacaranda trees drop their blossoms in an eerie purple rain, Los Angeles feels like only a half-formed dream. Like perhaps the city was founded as a strip mall in the early 1970s and has no real reason to exist. An afterthought from the designer of some other better city. A playground made only for attractive people to eat expensive salads. I'm flipping through a menu of such salads, overwhelmed with the ridiculousness of it all. Do I want a dressed array of greens with pickled yard-long beans? Perhaps I am more in the mood for sautéed beetroot and chicory. Or do I go all in with the 50-ingredient Guatemalan salad? This is the city I live in. Can I even name 50 salad ingredients? I purse my lips with indecision. They feel dry. I think I'm addicted to chapstick. I look up. Did I just say that out loud?
How can you be addicted to chapstick?
He asks, tossing back the last of his drink. His forehead is dripping sweat, but I don't think it's nerves. I think he's just the kind of guy who sweats a lot. Someone once told me they put trace amounts of ground-up glass in chapstick. That's how they get you addicted to it. The little shards of glass give you hundreds of microscopic cuts that dry out your lips, making you need more chapstick. I seriously looked at the label one time, as if in addition to 44% petrolatums, 1.5% patamate, 1% lanolin, and 0.5% cetyl alcohol, it was going to say 4.5% broken glass. It doesn't. He looks at me, stunned. Not knowing what else to do, I continue. It's a cover-up. The Whitehall Robins Healthcare Company of Madison, New Jersey, which distributes chapstick, is probably owned by the Altria Group, which is a made-up name for what used to be Philip Morris, to make people associate them less with tobacco. And then, to punctuate the sentence, they own a lot of stuff. I reach for the last piece of our jicama appetizer and shrug. Everything inside me told me I should have canceled this date. And now that I'm on it, I'm furious at myself for not listening. I should have held out for another date with the handsome hugger. But instead, this is me, living in the not knowing, and I hate it. This is a waste of our time. I know it. He knows it. He's not saying it, or anything, really. So I'm babbling to fill the silence. But seriously, I'm coming off like an idiot, and a bit of a conspiracy theorist. Not even the fun kind who believes in little green men. The other kind. The kind who writes manifestos and priority mails them with explosive devices. I wouldn't date me, and neither should he. We had decent email chemistry, this new guy and I. But that happens sometimes in online dating. A few zippy emails, some decent back and forth, and then in person, nada. Nothing. Zilch. I should be better at detecting when that's going to happen by now, but I'm not. It's still a roll of the dice. That's why I don't get excited anymore by a few zippy emails and some decent back and forth. It doesn't necessarily mean you'll have any real desire to see that person naked. Something like profuse sweating doesn't usually show up in pictures, especially if the pictures are of them being active. You think, oh, he's sweating because he's hiking Runyon Canyon, or tossing a frisbee at the beach. You don't imagine them sweating like this, sitting at a table reading a menu of salads. Are you addicted to anything? I realize I'd better bring him into the conversation before I launch into my monologue about Robitussin.
Sex.
I have no idea if this is a joke or not. If it is, it's kind of funny. If it's not, I might get raped. I play it off like it's a joke and move on. What do you do?
I'm a flight attendant, but I'm quitting that to become a professional dog walker.
Fucking L.A. Professional dog walker. Is that a thing? Are most dog walkers maintaining their amateur status to compete in the dog walking Olympics? I guess that's what I am. An amateur dog walker. It's where I should be now, enjoying a walk with Lily in the early evening. The gloom has parted just enough by 5 o'clock that there's some soft light streaming through that would make a walk with her seem nice. It could be the only sunlight we see for days. Suddenly I want to be here even less. That sounds like, how do I phrase this politely? Lateral move.
It's kind of a step up, actually.
That makes me feel bad for flight attendants. I cringe, imagining him handing me a ginger ale with his sweaty mitts.
Well, here it's a step up. In L.A., people will pay anything for their dogs. Do you have any pets?
No. I try to remember my dating profile, how much is on there about Lily, and weigh the chances that he actually read my profile and remember it well enough to know that I'm lying, or if he just flipped through my photos to find the one shirtless one. I shouldn't have written that thing a bottle deep in one of New Zealand's finer white wines, and I certainly shouldn't have posted a shirtless photo. That was the wine's fault.
Me neither. I want to, though, have a pet.
This, aside from the maybe sex joke, is the most interesting thing about him. I don't even know what he means by pet. Dog, cat, reptile, bird, one of those chirping keychains that Japanese children used to carry, hamster, fish, rock. But he wants one. I try to think of how to tactfully cut this short. If it's not going anywhere, there's so little connection here, there's not even interest in sex. There should be a socially acceptable way to just get up and walk out. I mean, if there's nothing obviously wrong with the other person, they are, as advertised, but you're just not, for whatever reason, feeling it. There should be a way to get up and leave. If there is something obviously wrong with them, you can say so right up front. Maybe not in those exact words, but you can say something like, "I'm sorry, I don't think this is going to be a match." Once I got a particularly creepy vibe from a guy just from his handshake, and we weren't meeting in a sufficiently public place, so I said just that, and left. Another time I wish I had said that up front, but instead suffered through dim sum while having to answer questions like, "Do you think you're the kind of person who could perform an emergency tracheotomy?" For the record, no, I do not. But once you're in the middle of a date, you're kind of committed to seeing it through to its natural conclusion. My first date with Jeffrey lasted 2 days. There was just so much to say. I suppose that sets a very high bar. Lily was asleep when I left, and I felt like one of those new parents who wanted to wake their sleeping baby to see if it was still alive. But while she normally sleeps on her left side, this afternoon she was on her right. Octopus side down. Good. Maybe it will suffocate in her paw print blanket. Otherwise, she was curled up in her usual way, the way that made me call her Bean. I'm already looking forward to whatever movie she and I may watch together when this interminable date is over. On Saturday nights, we watch movies. I hope she's well rested. Maybe we'll order Indian. The place up the street has these chickpeas in a tomato and ginger sauce that are really something. I think again about how to end this ordeal. Well, since you're not really that interesting in person, I think I'll head out. If only it were that easy. I should just go ahead and make a third date with the hugging guy. At least I was interested enough in him to want to know if he was interested in me. Why did I break the hug first? What about kids? I ask. Do you want kids? I like kids well enough. I have a niece that I'm crazy about, but I'm already too old to be a young father, and I don't particularly want to be an old father. And I'm single, and it's not something that I would do on my own. Nor do I have a particular drive to change my relationship status just to have kids, despite my being on a dating website. So, I don't really think kids are in the cards. No, definitely not. I don't get kids. Oh, well, there you go. I want to have kids. Need to have kids. Lots and lots of kids. We'll form a singing group and tour second-tier European cities like Dusseldorf. And just like that, there's my out. On the way home, I have a sudden craving for ice cream. I stop at the grocery store and head right to the frozen food aisle and select a pint of Ben & Jerry's Caramel Sutra for me and an individual cup of vanilla for Lily, because what the hell. One summer when she was young, we were driving somewhere together and I pulled over to the side of the road when I saw an ice cream place with one of those walk-up windows. We got out of the car and marched together across the gravel parking lot, and I ordered a mint chocolate chip ice cream cone, because the mint chocolate chip ice cream they had was green, and it always tastes better to me when it's green, even though the dye they use is probably carcinogenic. We sat at a picnic table on some grass, and I scooped Lily up into my lap.
What is this cloud that you're licking? I love to lick things. Would I like to lick that?
Even on my best days, I always wished life excited me as much as it excited her. So I lowered the cone to let her have a lick. The response was immediate.
This is amazing! We must have this to lick every single day!
It was impossible eating the rest of that cone. She stood on my lap and put her front paws on my chest, her tail ticking on its fastest setting. And then the back paws tried climbing, looking for footholds in my abs. Anything to hoist herself closer to her minty prize. Hey, 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 I objected. Sit. She did, steadying the paws on the right side of her body on my left leg and the paws on the left side of her body on my right leg while trying to maintain a semblance of balance. Her eyes looked up at me lovingly and with great anticipation. Someone once said, give a dog food and shelter and treats, and they think you are a god. But give a cat the same, and they think they are the god. We shared the rest of that ice cream cone, for I am a god. Sunday, 4:37 a.m. My legs jerk in that way that they do when I'm half asleep and dream that I'm falling and about to hit the ground. I wake up in a cold sweat, prop myself up, throw the covers back, and reach for Lily all in one fluid motion. The octopus is rattling the bed. Its limbs have come alive, all eight, and they swarm around Lily, gently but with purpose, and I just know that its dormancy is ending. I put my hand on Lily's chest. Nothing. I press down harder while my own heart stops. And then it comes. The familiar rise and fall of her muscled torso. She's still here. She's okay. The octopus's arms slow and then stop, and the terror becomes less immediate. and things go back to more or less the way they have been since I first noticed the octopus on Thursday. I try to remember if I was dreaming just now, just before I awoke.